We're excited to change the world of startups for the better, but trying to make a difference and turning our good intentions into reality has proven to be more complicated than expected. We constantly encounter unexpected second-order effects. When we solve one issue, we end up unintentionally creating another one. It's dawning on you that being a good leader is more complex than simply having that one big idea. True leadership is about the difficult decisions and trade-offs you encounter whilst executing it. On this show, we explore the entrepreneurial zeitgeist with the aim to work and lead differently. Between all of us, we can decode what it will take to be a leader today. Today, we discuss why having good intentions is not enough to have an impact on the world. You will learn about the intricacies and second-order effects of some of the hottest trends in startup culture. What are the downsides of financial transparency and profit sharing? Why would a wellness program ever lead to more stress? And do we really want radical ownership from our team members? My guest today is Gareth Herman. He's the founder of digital marketing agency Magic, and they are first and foremost catering to conscious companies. They famously worked on the presidential campaign for Marianne Williamson or the Denver Psilocybin Initiative. We talk about some of the creative new ways of working and leading that Gareth has implemented, the ones that worked out, and the ones that led to struggle, challenges, and unexpected consequences on the way. Let's dive in.
The focus is, are they making a difference? If so, can we help scale them up? And we started off very small. It was me and my business partners in our living room. We just essentially created a big desk and started off with just a couple small local clients.
When was that?
That was in 2018. But then we were very aggressive, and within a couple of years that, you know, had built like a 25 employee team. We're using about 25 contractors, so 50 total team members, around 2 million in revenue. And it just, the number of clients always varied, you know, from a dozen to a couple dozen, but yeah, very quick ramp up there. So those are some numbers and size to keep in mind in terms of, you know, what was our purpose, who we served, and the kind of work that we did and how big our team was.
I know that you've obviously been very creative with how you've built the company. You've incorporated a lot of play in the company. You've incorporated a lot of reflection and psychology, and you thought deeply about how to work and lead differently. Did you have an inspiration for that, or what made you so interested in finding a new way to build a company?
That's a great question. It actually started when I was an activist in Colorado. I was working on a startup, and in my free time, I was working with an organization to prevent hydraulic fracturing and natural gas extraction near water sources in schools and homes in our state. And through that process, we actually started to, you know, work towards moving state laws. But right before the pinnacle of our campaign, the leaders of our organization, I was on the leadership team, two leaders got in a fight, and some of them literally stole the signatures we'd gathered and prevented us from submitting the signatures. And so what I saw was that just having a positive intention wasn't enough to create an impact in the world. What we really need to do at the same time is work on our inner game and our own inner psychology, our trauma, our wounding, our mindsets, our beliefs, because they impact our work and they impact our teammates when we work with them. It's kind of like any relationship. And so that was the original point of inspiration for me to realize that, hey, transformational work and healing work needs to be done with the individuals, especially the leadership team in an organization, in order for it to actually be successful in achieving its outcomes and goals. And luckily at the time, the startup I was working on was we were hoping to create a competitor to Techstars to reinvent the business accelerator model. And so I was actually interviewing and researching. I think I interviewed over like 50 different companies and leaders all over the world that were working on how to do business differently. So I feel like I got a really interesting beat on everything from holacracy to distributed leadership to spiral dynamics, all these different ways, distributed equity and ownership, like very innovative ways that companies were trying to change the way the game was played. And I felt very grateful that at Magic, we ended up selling the company this year. You know, I had the opportunity to implement some of those ideals and inspirations and new ways of doing work. So I feel very grateful for that.
Yeah. And you sent me a nice list beforehand of some of the stuff that you've worked on. And obviously, I want to get kind of into intricacies, because one of the premise of this podcast is that a lot of these things sound very polished and obvious and beautiful when you listen to them on a TED Talk. And then the challenges and kinks and weirdness and second order effects unfold as you implement them. And you're all of a sudden faced with consequences that you maybe didn't imagine when you set out. But before we go into that, what are maybe the top one or top three activities that you were inspired by, that you implemented, and that have worked very smoothly for you?
I think the smoothest was Leading with Why from Simon Sinek. I really took that podcast and book and TED Talk to heart. And every single sales call, we would lead off with, what's the why of your company? What's our why? Every single interview when we were hiring someone, let off with the why. What's, you know, this is Magic's why. What's your why? Why do you exist? And even took that down to a teams and project level. Like, for example, when we got big enough, I created the finance team or the people ops team or the client success team. And we would go through a whole team formation process that I learned from Techstars. But what was missing from that was the why. So we always stuck that in first, is what's the why? And that had zero negative effects. It always, I felt, brought people more into a heart space and a place of inspiration and possibility, and to engage in that way before starting a sales call, a hiring interview, a, you know, even a project, like, why are we doing this project? And really getting deep into what's the meaning of this. And I think the sales team came with some really great stuff. They said, like, well, we exist, we're the lifeblood of the company, you know, and our company, we bring in the money, and that's the fuel that fuels all of the of our work. And that got them really motivated and excited. And I think it also helped our clients and everyone. Business is hard. It's stressful. And just taking a moment to be reminded about, why did you even start your own business? And why is it important to you? I think was a refreshing break for people. And in the interviews, people too said, this is the best interview I've ever had. And it really had a positive impact across the board.
What do you think made it so successful? Was it that you so consistently brought it to the forefront, or were there other factors that made it work so well for you?
I just think that, yeah, two things. One, it engages people. I think I said it brings people into their heart and gets them more emotionally engaged. And yeah, I do think consistency is just something that we did across the board all the time. And it became part of our culture, and people really appreciated that.
And I'm also curious, you obviously tried a lot of experimental stuff. Did you also try any quote unquote classic textbook business advice? And if so, what would that be?
Yeah, I think, you know, something that we did was we took the Rockefeller habits and adopted the one-page strategic plan. So that was extremely helpful. And, you know, setting goals and breaking those down into projects, I think that's very block and tackle business advice. And I personally had I have my millionaire mentor. He's my uncle. He's in the auto industry, you know, from the East Coast, and is just a very traditional old school business guy. So, you know, as one of his favorite quotes is, there's two most important things in life are cash flow and net worth. And so that, you know, there's some of that, the business basics that are really needed. You know, the game is operated in a certain way. And if you don't operate by those rules, then you can no longer play in the game. You have to have money, and you have to block and tackle, and you have to, you know, have the basics. So I felt that we did have a very strong business foundation where we had our strategic plan. I had the finance team create a custom financial dashboard for us. We were tracking all of our key KPIs, everything from revenue to expenses to projections, key client risk heat maps, the whole nine yards. I feel like that we were very numbers driven and numbers oriented to keep the business financially viable. And I think that was very traditional of us.
And I'm obviously playing devil's advocate here. Do you think that is a contradiction to a very emotional, heart-centered, why-driven approach? Or is that actually something that works like complementary to each other?
It's a yes and. And it also creates challenges, right? Because if you think about change, there's two approaches to change. Usually there's evolution and there's revolution. Revolution is, we're going to tear the thing down and build something new. And evolution is, we're going to take this one step forward. And I think part of our challenges at Magic is that we wanted to be revolutionary about things, but we were still playing the existing game of capitalism. And that created conflicts and challenges. For example, Some cultures end up being more like sport teams where it's all about competition and performance. Other cultures end up being more like a family, and ours felt more like a family. And we even had a new term called fro workers, which is like friends and coworkers, because it wasn't just about that, just about getting the stuff done. You know, creating deep emotional connections and bonds between members was amazing for trust, transparency, getting things done, high performing teams. But then when the business was under pressure, you know, an agency, let's say we lost a key client and we had to lay people off, it was like going through a breakup every time. And it was really challenging and hard because the numbers of the business, as a business owner, it felt like every time this was a free experience for me. It's like, oh, I have to put the team on a life raft to get to this new island. But to get there, I have to kick some people off the life raft so the rest of the people can get there. And it felt that way. And so that was a real challenge where we were, you know, operating from a place of being financially responsible, being on top of the numbers, and, you know, having the financial foundation in place. But those financial pressures, I felt, led me to do things that sort of went against our culture. And I think had a negative impact on our culture because people could feel that it's like, hey, this isn't a heart-centered decision, or it doesn't feel that way on the receiving end. And so that really put me in a tough place a lot of times where, yeah, I literally cried several times when having to let people go or having difficult conversations. It was intense.
You touched on something like, as we're still working in the system of capitalism, and I'm thinking about this a lot also in the terms of like, how do we do marketing, et cetera. As you're playing that game, abiding to the rules of the game, potentially trying to stretch and expand them, but still kind of bound by them, that creates an interesting tension and also a tension for creativity, but it's not an easy process. And I think that is where a lot of these struggles come with. This is where the disconnects, I think, come from when we're trying to do things differently. What were some of the things that you were so inspired by that you absolutely wanted to do that you thought like, this is 100% going to be a great idea and revolutionize the way we work together? And then it led to more headaches downstream.
Yeah, let me think about that. I think one of those things was financial transparency and wanting to do profit sharing. So
can you explain what you mean by financial transparency?
Sure, absolutely. So we had our leadership team read The Great Game of Business by, I think, Joe Burlington. I forget his exact name, but it's a book on how to essentially share ownership in the company and have everyone act like an owner. And that was one of our core values at Magic, was ownership mindset, because we wanted people to take responsibility for their lives. And that worked really well when we were a really small team. So we would go over our P&L every single month, and we would go over line item by line item, and it was actually financial literacy for our team members, helping them understand, you know, where was all the money going, how much did things cost, and actually how did they impact each line item on the P&L. And that was really important to us for a business, because oftentimes I believe employees think that the owners are making a lot more money. And especially at the beginning, Marcus and I were not paying ourselves barely anything, and they could see that. And so that was really helpful in terms of transparency, is that it cleared up a lot of potential resentment or imagination or stories about what was happening with the money and where it was going. And we wanted, as leaders, we wanted that because we wanted people to see, hey, what I do and how much time I spend on this client, even if I'm a graphic designer, has a real impact on the business. And the more efficient I am with my time, the more it's going to help the business and us win as a team. That worked really well when the business was doing well. People felt inspired and motivated when we were crushing it and like a rocket ship. Everyone could feel that, and we're like emotionally engaged and we're excited, and, you know, and then people wanted raises and it was all good and profit sharing. It took us a while to get to the point of profit sharing, because at the first 2 years, almost three, we had to reinvest almost all the money into the business. But there was a point then where we started kicking off some profit shares, and people really loved that. Unfortunately, right after that, we went through the iOS 14 updates, which in our industry had a huge impact, and people cut their Facebook ad programs completely. Some scaled back significantly. And so we had probably a 6-month period of challenges and no new sales. And so then when the company wasn't doing well, people didn't have the guts or the sort of entrepreneurial grit to withstand looking at a P&L that was decreasing every month. And so that really brought down morale then, and people started quitting because they lost faith in the leadership in the company. And they got more into their survival mind of, where's my job security? So that was a learning there, is that not everyone, and that was always my wish. Like my wish was that there would be a revolution where everyone would learn how to take responsibility for their lives, their mindset, their emotions, no longer be a victim to their circumstance, and be able to increase their emotional capacity to withstand wins and losses. But that was naive thinking, and not everyone wants that. That was something I learned, is that I wanted that for people. I wanted that for my team, but not everyone actually wants that ownership in their own lives or the company. And that's okay. And that needs to be honored and respected. There's people that don't have that transparency into how the whole company is doing. They don't want to feel responsible for all of that. And that was a big learning for me in adjusting my own wishes, desires, and mental models for people in the world.
You said a couple of things here that I find very interesting. One, sharing the entire P&L. I'm kind of impressed by this, because it's obviously, like you said, it needs a huge level of like insight to understand the different items, to understand what it means. And so I think when we talk about financial transparency, right, there could be like sharing about revenue numbers, et cetera. But I do think that's actually quite a great level of detail, especially done on a monthly basis. And so I'm actually very, very impressed about that level of openness. And then on the other side, like you said, I love that. I love that if I can talk about finances with people, how is their revenue going? How profitable are they? What is happening? Where is their money going to? I find that very interesting. And I find that empowering, because I think German culture and American culture, I think to a degree as well, is not like that. Like, you don't talk about your salary and how your business is doing and how is the revenue. And I think I've always found that quite liberating to see how other people are doing, to benchmark myself and understand a little bit better what is going on in my company, et cetera. But like you said, I understand that not everyone has the same passion. And then especially if you're very interested in maybe beautiful stories, interesting companies, interesting ways of changing the world, then maybe that also like even less makes you want to look at the finances. But yeah, I've always seen finances kind of like as a gamification. But that has always held me back from having 100% open books, because I sometimes dream of it. But I feel like it needs a lot of explaining around where money goes, what is it good for, around salary structures, around global salaries, around investing in the company, and where does the money go, around owner salary, around market rates, et cetera. And so that has always held me back from doing that. And so I'm even more impressed about the level of detail that you went there with your team.
What we worked on towards the end, when we hired our chief people officer, Jennifer, is that we then made transparent. We had a salary, a career map. Okay, well, this is the three different levels of a graphic designer, a media buyer, and an account manager. And here's the benchmarks roughly for what that would be. And so, you know, people can understand that this is what I can expect to make, because it's all about the role and what that role is valued in the marketplace, not your individual worth and so on and so forth. And because we were so mission driven, we weren't able to like leverage geographical or global arbitrage, because we needed people in the US that really understood the culture and the why. And it was a very high quality of work, because someone that cares about making a difference, the messaging and the way that it's created and delivered and represented is so important. So we didn't have as high margins as other agencies because we weren't leveraging a lot of overseas talent at a lower cost rate. And yeah, that was a trade-off we decided to make.
Oh, yeah. I mean, obviously, that is a huge in the agency game. And then always the question of, obviously, how many accounts does everyone have? And then how many juniors do you pull into? How much work to kind of compensate for that? It's a beast.
Well, that was another thing, was that within the game of capitalism, the agency space is so competitive, where I'll use account managers, for example. That was the most stressful position, because you're managing the client relationship. And if ad performance is great, the clients are happy. But if it's not, they often blame, you know, the account managers or the team versus any number of other factors that could be impacting the campaign. And so that was an emotionally challenging position. And the way that the numbers work for the business the business wasn't very profitable for us unless everyone had more work than they could really handle and were stressed out. And so I felt like that was a huge conflict for me personally, because one of my personal values is health and vitality. Yeah. And so I was, you know, making my teammates take on too much work to make the numbers for the business work, even though I didn't want them to. I felt like I didn't have a choice unless I were to leverage overseas talent. So yeah, there was a lot of situations like that where you have to do what's best for the business in order to play the game, even though your heart is telling you to do something different. And that was a lot of the pain that I went through as a founder and with the team, because we even tried one of the things on the list I shared with you was the well-being game, you know, trying to create a program for our employees, then to manage that emotional stress from the clients. You know, we offered coaching, especially for account managers, around how to reframe, you know, emotional tools. You know, we taught them about like the drama triangle, you know, how to not take on clients' emotions or how to not take things personally. And also then if they got triggered, how to work through self-worth issues or confidence or all of these things that get triggered in those relationships then. So we offered a co-pay model for coaching to help them work through that. And we had a well-being game as a company where, you know, you would score points for going for a walk, taking a break, doing yoga, and actually setting your own habits and lifestyle goals so that you could counterbalance that work from stress. But that was also a challenge, because then it felt like work for people too. It's like once you're already stressed out and in a pattern of being in a stress response, you know, you can carry that same energy into a meditation or a workout or whatever. And then it just feels like more work to try to squeeze the workout in, and you're not actually hitting the reset button on the central nervous system. And yeah, agency life's tough.
Yeah. In one of the previous episodes, I spoke with Brent, who's the head coach at Flow Research Collective, Re-Endurance organization. And I talked with him about this. When I'm really stressed, the last thing I want to do is take a walk, eat, go to the gym, meditate. Feels like a giant distraction. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm already stressed. I'm already behind. I need to work more. It's like, really don't have time to spend an hour on this, when it's exactly what I should be doing, right? But it's so hard to prioritize that. And it's so hard to step away from that fight or flight hustle response. Yeah, very, very much agree with that. Seems to have a little bit the work hard, play hard culture as well. You've been writing, we've been doing some Brenner style company retreats. What does that mean? What have you been doing in your retreats and offsites?
Sure. So one of the principles of Burning Man is participation. And so we built that into our company retreats. So instead of us saying, hey, here's the company retreat agenda, we're going to do this, we co-created the agenda. And we had all of the people of the company lead different parts of the retreat. And we made everything opt-in at Magic. You know, after we grew to a couple, you know, more than a couple team members, very clear that we, as we grew, and especially when we grew fast, we weren't always able to, we grew too quickly sometimes and hired people that weren't like super aligned with our culture, and especially personal growth and Burning Man. That was a little much for a lot of people. When our core team started out, everyone was, you know, I'd go to the burn and see Magic employees there, and that was just the culture. But then when we grew faster, that wasn't as comfortable for everyone. So we always made everything opt-in. I think that's a best practice that I learned the hard way, is to give people a choice. Where's their boundaries? Where's their comfort zone? So for example, in our Magic retreats, one of our team members would say, well, hey, I want to offer yoga, and or hey, I want to offer a breathwork session. Well, not everyone's going to be into breathwork, but at least that's co-created by the participants for the participants of the retreat and is available for them to choose. So we did that in addition to our, you know, I always put stuff like, okay, what's our one-page strategic plan? You know, let's do a deep dive on the core values, or let's focus in on sales or this other thing where we're going to workshop some area of the business. And yeah, other people wanted to do like workouts or have fun. And so we built that all in, and that was co-created. And then of course we always had a, not of course, but at night we would always then throw parties where there'd be, you know, someone from the team would DJ or put on a playlist. And my business partner, Marcus, was an amazing freestyler. So he would freestyle rap. We actually have an artist on the team, Aslan, Nicholas Aslan, who's also a conscious rapper. So he would go, we had someone bring a guitar. So, and then, yeah, the burner costumes would come out. We would bring extra for the team members that weren't into that, you know, so that they could at least put on like a unicorn onesie or, you know, something, or maybe just like some funny ears if they didn't feel comfortable dance partying and anything other than normal clothes. So that was a way to be inclusive and bring people into that culture without making them join. But it always ended up being so much fun. It was the highlight for everyone, you know, hot tub, dance party, workouts, meditation, business workshops, breath work. We also did a lot of authentic relating, like sharing your life story and, you know, really helping team members get to know each other on a deeper level. So they were really beautiful and powerful.
I love it. I mean, that sounds like the best time to be having. So imagine this. It's the afternoon of the company retreat. One of your teammates is offering yoga. One of the teammates is offering hot tub. And you're offering one-page strategic plan. How many people are really coming to the one-page strategic plan versus the hot tub? I feel like this is going to be hard to...
Well, we made that part of the schedule mandatory. we built the optional stuff around. There was like always a couple of core things we needed to do as a company that we made everyone attend.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like otherwise the one-page strategic plan might have a hard time competing.
But you'd be surprised. I mean, especially, you know, team members really cared about their work and the account managers were like, hey, I really want to have a creative meeting, our creative process. And it was because it was causing them pain, right? It's like, I'm delivering these creatives to the client. I'm getting the feedback. I want to meet with the creative team and we need to rehash these three things. And they really look forward to their treat to take a break from the day-to-day. You know, it's really hard to work on the business when you're stressed already enough working in the business. So you'd be surprised. Some team members actually really wanted to do work on a specific process or workflow or challenge that was making their job more difficult, which is what I love about having a co-creative culture, because allowing people to solve their own problems and providing them space and resources to do that is amazing. You know, it takes the pressure off the leadership to be on top of everything. You know, if you just ask them, we did that all the time in our one-on-ones, like what's working, what's not, and what do you want to do about it? And giving them the agency. We had a lot of meritocracy in the business where, you know, and may the best idea win. Just, you know, anyone, I had such a painful experience owning my own business in high school. And then after college, being an intern and being completely devalued in terms of a strategic resource, that was one thing that people really enjoyed about Magic. And some people really took advantage of it. Doesn't matter if you were a copywriter or a media buyer or an account manager, if you had a better idea of how to do something, that was always welcome. And we were always into testing and workshopping anyone's idea from any department to see if that would be the best.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, for me, people bringing on new ideas is like one of the values that I like to live the most. I'm not so into the, you know, move fast and break stuff attitude that this sometimes turns into. But when someone has an idea, I try to almost always say yes, just because I like it when people have like new ideas and new solutions and want to get their own projects going.
There's a way that we facilitated that in too. I did a course with Otto Scharmer, Leading from the Emerging Future. He's an MIT professor. And so when we were creating the vision for Magic or the 3-year plan, I would lead the entire company through a meditation, a 10-minute meditation, where we'd literally be getting into sensing the emerging future and sharing sights, colors, sounds, somatic experiences, visions, words. And so we were really crowdsourcing the future of the company from the company itself. And that's a lot of how our visions and goals would get created, would be out of, you know, out of a group sensing experience. And I would say that was a pretty cool technology that I was very excited to implement. And I love doing that, even, you know, Fractal, like you can do that for the whole company, but I wasn't involved in project work that much. But if I were to get involved in a creative brainstorm from a client, I would, again, ask the team to go in that meditative space and really allow the, you know, the whole system to be involved creatively and coming up with the angles and the campaigns and the ideas. And I really enjoyed that.
Amazing. Talk to me for a second. You mentioned one-on-ones, team meetings. How did you structure that? Who was doing that and what happened in these one-on-ones?
Yeah, so that was something I was very passionate about, was meetings, because, you know, you're not working when you're in a meeting. And so I created a whole training around high-performance meetings for the team. I studied them and not everyone always adhered to them, including myself, but it was nice to have that standard of having a purpose for the meeting, a clearly defined agenda, and you know, action items coming out of the meeting. That was sort of the basics. And again, I don't think if I was not around that, I don't think that got adhered to very much, but it was good to have that be the standard.
Is there always the founders that want action items in the end of the meeting?
Absolutely. Yeah. And then you always take the next level. I'm very passionate about project management. So it was, you know, I want to see it in, we were using Asana at the time. Now everyone's using ClickUp, but it's like, you know, yeah. After the meeting, we need to see that translated into the workflow. And then how that translated into, well, I'll talk about our meeting structure and cadence first. We would have, you know, our annual retreats. Then we would have a, you know, our monthly financial review meeting. And that would be a weekly meeting where we talk about the business, where we would just share about what's going on in the business, have each department head check in and just keep transparency across the whole company, what projects are being worked on by which department, quick updates from everyone. And yeah, just a general business check-in and then a surfacing of problems or tensions or issues that we wanted to work through and connect on. So that was a weekly meeting. And then we had another weekly meeting that was our weekly review ritual that was solely focused on connection and culture, where we would do a quick check-in prompt and then we would ask a personal question, like, you know, ranging from as simple as like, what was the coolest vacation you ever went on? You know, as deep as like, what's your life's purpose? And that was a really beautiful way for us to build connection over time. And then we did celebrations. So for the weekly review rituals, roughly like 30 minutes of check-in and, you know, how'd the week go, rosebud, thorn, whatever prompt. And then there would be celebrations and acknowledgements of 30 minutes, like giving thanks, acknowledging people, celebrating them. That was the second half. And then those were the company cadence meetings. And then we had department meetings then if, you know, the whole creative team needed to meet once a month or so on and so forth. Or all the account managers or management meetings, we would structure those in. And then we had one-on-ones where I was doing them at first before we built out our people ops team. But then we would check in with our team members either weekly or biweekly, or I think we started off monthly. And we would do peer reviews and one-on-ones to help people get feedback and make sure they were being checked in on and having their voices heard and their problems solved.
Who came to the weekly company meeting? Is that everyone? So that could be like 30, 40 people in that call very easily.
Yes.
Amazing. Yeah, I think I got to step up our like company meeting structure when I hear this. So we're obviously smaller. We're 6 full-time, 6 part-time now. And we do have like a weekly core team meeting. But the big company update right now is on a monthly basis and then kind of irregular on top. And so I definitely feel we can probably tighten the loop on that.
There's no right or wrong answer to that question because it's very expensive. If you think about everyone, what everyone costs dollar per hour, meetings is, you know, the biggest expense. And so it's really a business priority. For us, it felt very important with our ownership mindset culture and having that be a core value that we actually practice that. So that's not necessarily the right cadence for every company, but because that was one of our core values and we really wanted each of our team members to think like a business owner, treating them like they were a business owner and letting them know what was going on across the whole company each week was important to us. And so that's why we met that frequently. Most companies, yeah, do that once a month or once a quarter and not every single week. And yeah, there was times where we did it biweekly as well. But the reason it was valuable for me is that everyone was then synced up and they became very quick updates. Then everyone just stays on top of the pulse and not no like major updates are needed. Everyone kind of knows what's happening in the company and why. And so that creates cohesion and also improves morale because everyone's then focused on the goals. Everyone knows what the goals of the company is focused on and what we're doing about it. So even if there's a problem, you know, everyone's hearing all the things everyone's doing to address that problem.
A personal question, how did that play out for your call schedule? Because I'm probably the person who has most of the calls in the company, which sometimes that is a contradiction because I'm very inspired by this entire idea of calm company, obviously flow states and the call Swiss cheese schedule, you know, meeting, 30 minutes off, meeting, 15 minutes off, meeting. It's the enemy of the flow state and the calm company. However, I do find myself often having a Swiss cheese schedule day. And so I'm curious, how did your day and your call schedule look like?
It varied over time. So agencies at different stages of profitability. You know, when you're very small, there's a really high profitability stage, and you grow to this mid-size, it's less profitable. And then once you start adding in management, you become sometimes unprofitable until you get to the scale where each person has a full team under them. So anyway, so there was times where I had to absorb other roles in order to make the numbers work for the business. And that time it was way too much, like trying to run accounts myself while managing the finance team, ops. It was just insane. You know, and I would have, you know, 5 to 7, sometimes even 10 Zoom calls a day. And it was absolutely insane. That was just more of a function of how profitable was the business and how far did I sacrifice my personal lifestyle to take on how many roles to make the company profitable for the business. That was the key decision that I was making. We were very conscious about constantly reducing the number of meetings and trying to, you know, in the high performance meeting protocol, it's like this, you're using the meetings to brainstorm, make decisions, or debate things. You're not, that's the only point of having a meeting. And if you can solve all of that asynchronously, you try to first before calling a meeting. So I think we did a pretty good job of that. And anytime that we were out of balance, having too many meetings, a team member would complain and then we would reel it back. And yeah, and at the end of the day, those two calls of the week, I mentioned the weekly sync call around the business and the weekly review ritual. Those are actually my two favorite calls of the week because that's when I felt connected to the mission and the goals that we were moving towards and what we were doing to go towards them. And that was very emotionally important for me. And then doing the weekly review ritual, feeling that deep sense of connection and appreciation for the team and the love and the culture, that's like what made it all worth it for me. It's like, it reminded me of like why I was, you know, going through so much stress and challenges the rest of the week because one of my mantras to myself was like, if I was going through a hard time, is like, just remember, like, do it for Tyler. Like, I would imagine like Tyler, one of my our best team members, and I'm getting emotional just talking about him. He had a wife, and he wanted to start a family and get another house. And so my mantra was like, do it for Tyler. Like, we're trying to improve his life, and that was a huge source of motivation for me. So I think they were expensive meetings, but they were absolutely worth it to me.
Yeah, I totally understand. It's very interesting observing how you talk about this, like the struggle with the profitability of an agency and the ways of scaling. And obviously in the beginning, an agency, you know, makes a lot of money compared to a product business because, you know, you get paid pretty quickly, pretty highly, et cetera. But then compared to a product business, obviously it's not that scalable. And then that awkward middle pass time where it's not really an asset yet that runs without you, but you have the managers, but haven't really have the revenue up yet to justify having all the managers. And I can relate with all of that very, very much. And I think I really appreciate, even in our conversation, your honesty and openness about this, because I feel like a lot of agency and service business owners or leaders can resonate, you know, with that struggle and that challenge. And then, as you said, balancing the vision and the company that you want to be creating and the lifestyle that you want to be providing for the team with the realities of making ends meet and often sacrificing yourself in the process, I think is a very, very hard reality for a lot of agency owners and people. You mentioned a few times is treating the team as business owners. And obviously you have been very, very committed and you've been doing a lot of things to kind of like make it work for the company. And so how does that fit the role of the founders, the commitment of the founders? Obviously the company is kind of like your baby. And in many ways, you're one of the people who cares most about it. But then in their, you know, respective areas, people might actually care more than you, and you should, and that's wanted. And so I'm curious on that role of the founder versus people thinking and understanding like a business owner. How does that relationship or interplay look like in practice, or how did it look like for you?
This is what I was sharing about. Some people don't want to be a business owner. They want to be an employee. And I think that was a mindset shift I had to make from wanting the world to, I think from my mindset and perspective of the world changed after going to a number of workshops, like, under, you know, running my own business, going up against changing laws in, you know, statewide laws, and really understanding how power structures and the legal system works and the game of capitalism works. I think my views about money and ownership and responsibility changed a lot. And as we grew, there's a lot of conflict, or that created gaps and challenges, because I was putting my own wants and desires to have a society or a team that embodied more of those ownership mindset principles. But the challenge was that the team members that I was bringing on sometimes wanted that, sometimes didn't. And then oftentimes hadn't done the same trainings I had or didn't have the same life experiences, where you naturally evolve to taking more ownership of your life, your mindset, your emotions, your circumstances. And so some of them felt like that was being put on them, and that created resistance and naturally. So that was a big learning for me as a leader, was to just help people in their journey of life to get to the next step, no matter where that is, instead of, you know, wanting them to be in a certain mindset or state if they're not, and to really respect where people were at. And yeah, that played out in a number of different ways, from just like morale and how people showed up on calls and who did what. And at the end of the day, I also saw that the business sometimes needed people that just take the order, do the thing. And that was also valuable to the team, to have team members that didn't necessarily want to reinvent everything all the time or take things in a new direction, and just were happy to put their heads down, get it done, and go home. And so there's a lot of value to have strong workers on the team as well. So yeah, I don't know if that really answers your question, but that's a huge paradigm shift. You know, that there's the 15 Commitments of Conscious Leadership, which was a book club initiative we did, which has a very nice framework of going from a victim mindset to ownership mindset, to then going to this like creator mindset, and then a very sort of like spiritual oneness mindset. And everyone is in a different stage. And really, people have emotional reactions to the different stages and judgments and opinions. For example, if you're in the ownership mindset stage, you often judge the victims judge the owners. If you're in the creator, you don't really understand oneness. And that's a very sensitive piece, is people's personal identities, where they are in their journeys and their evolution of consciousness. And you have to be very, I learned to be very sensitive to that, because I didn't handle that very well as a leader on the onset.
Yeah, I appreciate you reminding that, because also for the reason that I think with us in our circles, we tend to think that the picture of being a founder, being an entrepreneur, is kind of the goal, is the vision. This is how you get your freedom. And also realizing that essentially, I mean, our companies are built by team members, and they are bringing that forward. And it's maybe not necessary for everyone to have their own company. And I myself, for example, I don't consider myself so much an idea generator. I'm very good at getting on board with ideas and making it happen. And there's probably value in that as well. And I think that this idea that, you know, everyone should be entrepreneurial is maybe not necessary and doesn't make for the strongest team. And appreciating for what people are bringing to the table, so that the team as a whole is kind of complete, right? As you say, some people are really strong at execution. Is there anything else that you wanted to say or share, or that you think is important about your journey and your learnings and the complications of building a meaningful company that I didn't ask about, but that you wanted to end with?
I think the most important thing we actually haven't covered yet, which is the inner game. A lot of the conversation we've been talking about is what are sort of the tactics and strategies to implement, let's say, new policies, structures, ways of being, culture, you know, whatever, in the business itself, as how to run a team. I think the most important thing that we haven't touched on yet is the inner game of your own values, beliefs, emotional blocks, traumas from the past as a founder, and how to engage in that process. Because despite my best intentions, you know, I was like, okay, cool, I'm starting this new business, I'm going to therapy, I'm actually going to make all my business partners, make my business partners go to therapy with me. That's like a deal breaker for me. We're going to do our inner work so that we won't like project our own issues onto the company and have our shadow and our unconscious come out and play out in our company culture. Despite all of my best intentions of trying to head that off the pass, that's exactly what happened, right? So, you know, that I think that's something that everyone needs to be aware of, or that I'd love that to be more a part of the conversation, is that generally most founders that start a scalable business or have big aspirations generally have like some sort of belief that they're like better than everyone else, which usually comes from a wound of not feeling not good enough or rejected in some way and needing to compensate for that. And it's kind of funny. We did like a high performance training, my business partner and I, and they gave us a test, which they told us was an entrepreneurial test, and asked us all these very personal questions. But at the end, pretty much everyone scored pretty high on it. And at the end, they told us actually a test of being bipolar. And so,
ouch.
So there's, I think having that be part of the conversation more is most important, because those are the things that generally cause a company or a culture to disintegrate, are the unspoken issues. conscious or unconscious, of the leadership team and also of the team members. Sometimes there's conflict in a team because there's tactical issues that are happening, but half the time it's really personal stuff that's coming up for team members. But if that's not okay to work through in the workplace, then the root cause is never going to be, you can train the tactical skills into someone, but if they're having an emotional block to a risk resistance from their own childhood or their own past that's coming up in the workplace, and it's not okay to process that, work through that, then they're always going to struggle with that. And that's going to have a negative impact on the client, on their own career. And having a core value of personal growth as a company, that was my goal, was to make it okay for everyone to be having a human experience and have that work-life integration where, you know, what happens off the court does impact what happens on the court, and who you are as a person does impact your role. And just making that okay and normal, I think, is very important, and to be able to have that conversation and then the training and skills to work through that. And that's really where I felt like we could have had a better job at Magic, where we had the culture of openness and realness, but then people's inner game, whether it's the founders, like we had a professional therapist working with us, and how to integrate that in the team culture. I think that's a really edge to be on, and you need a lot of training and understanding. Because as we grew as a company, we made some hires and that really backfired on us, because having the openness without enough training and support, it's almost like with a lot of freedom, you need a lot of responsibility and training, and lacking that, it became quite destructive, where people's personal issues started to surface, but then it just got projected onto other people and caused chaos and conflict versus it actually being transformational, healing, and empowering. So yeah, a lot of lessons learned there that I feel like we could do a whole podcast just on that.
I think the reason why this also comes out so much in agency game, I think, is because inherently it's relational, right? You are a service business, you are a service provider, the consulting services is inherently relational. Though I do think even every product business in the end is a people's business. And so I'm kind of curious, you guys have really intertwined life and work in many, many ways. As you say, the friends and coworkers, the personal development, the therapist, etc. Like, how do you look at that now? Do you think that was a good thing that life and work became so intertwined? Do you think about boundaries? Do you think about that differently now? Where do you stand?
My stance is, again, making it opt-in. I think that it depends on the size of the team and it depends on the goals of the company. And it depends on if people are willing to play the game of life in that way. I would assert that regardless if you want it to or not, it's all mental constructs to try to separate things, but that's kind of an illusion. But that's necessary at a certain stage of consciousness. So I would say that life is happening all the time, whether you're a father or a teacher or a team member or a leader, or everything impacts everything. It's all connected. So I think that that's the truth of reality. And my recommendation would be to respect where people are. Like, some people are at the stage where they want to have a difference. Like, maybe they put on a role at work and that's what works for them. And they put on a mask to go to their job. And that's a way to compartmentalize and make their life work. And if that's the game they're playing, I wouldn't try to get them to change that unless they ask for it. And that's the main lesson that I would impart, is that, yeah, it's really meeting people where they're at and respecting that, and letting them go on the journey that they want to go on. And other people, yeah, that were, I mean, we had other feedback that, you know, working at Magic was the most life-changing thing they did and had the best impact in their life, and that it was like the most incredible culture. And then a couple people it really didn't work for, and there was people in the middle. So I think that it's just a very sensitive topic. And as a culture and society, working with our unconscious issues and bringing them to light and doing that in a healthy way, whether it's in a relationship or in the work environment, is like very new. And it just needs to be handled with extreme sensitivity and respect for each person where they're at emotionally and what they want. But for me personally, that's where I'm at in my journey, is that it's all on the table for me, because I know that my beliefs, my values, my actions, it impacts everything. And if I work on me, there's going to be a ripple effect on my relationships, my work, my role, my identity, everything. So for me, my life is integrated. Like, my personal passion and purpose is intertwined with the businesses that I create in the world. And the values that I value personally are influencing the businesses. And the business has an impact on me and I have an impact on it. And there's a relationship there. and an integration there. It's not like I have it fragmented out. And some people want to do life that way and other people don't. And you have to honor and respect that.
Aho. Do you ever feel you're being vulnerable by being so open and being sharing so much of yourself?
I've actually learned to tone it back in terms of vulnerability because it's really hardened me in certain situations. Like the vulnerability really has to be invited, because just even in sharing my truth and what's alive for me in the moment can have a very intense impact on people. So that's something that I've had to learn as a leader, is what's the right level of vulnerability and openness to bring to a conversation, because too much can trigger other people. It can be overwhelming. It could be unasked for. And it's a very interesting topic of how vulnerable do you actually need to be in a conversation, because vulnerability creates trust, it builds relationship, and it builds connection. But the truth that gets revealed in vulnerability can be too intense or too triggering for people. And that's something that I'm still working on today in my personal relationships and my work relationships, is reading the room. And it's a little harder over Zoom, but it's just as necessary to know what's the right level of vulnerability did it bring to a conversation, and what's appropriate to share, because there's relational risks and also legal risks. Operating in the game of capitalism or a legal framework, sharing certain things is actually illegal. And one more vanilla example I could share is around plant medicine and psychedelics. Well, that's actually an illegal substance in many places of the world. And, we took a risk as a company to say, this is an area that we're willing to be very vulnerable about and push the envelope on. And we're willing to deal with the legal, financial, and emotional risks that are associated with sharing around the use of psychedelics in plant medicine, because we believe it's going to make the world a better place. It's going to heal PTSD and trauma. And it's, these plant medicines are here to help us. And if we're going to get sued because of that, if we're going to have team members not want to join our culture because of that, if we're going to have clients turn us away because of that, we're okay accepting those risks. And we're going to take a stand for being vulnerable about this topic. So yeah, I feel like it's a skill and a practice I feel is very important to cultivate as a leader, that both the ability to be vulnerable and then the situational awareness to share what level of vulnerability is appropriate.
Yeah, I'm impressed. I will say that if you ever want to come back on the show, you anyways, obviously always invited, but I'm impressed with the level of financial transparency as well as personal sharing and honesty in this conversation, but I assume also you had with your team, and trusting people that they can handle this and that they have the maturity level and insight to receive you in that such a way. I think it's a very strong way forward.
Thanks, Viola. It's been an amazing, I'm very inspired about this conversation. I'm grateful that you're bringing these conversations to the world. And like you said, you read all these cool things in a book, but when the rubber hits the road and you implement and you run across those real issues, I love the groundedness and the practicality of taking inspiration and innovation, but actually seeing it play out in a company culture and noticing those second order effects. And I think the more that we can share these conversations as business owners, the more we can evolve and grow together. So I really appreciate the messages and the conversations you're putting forth here today, and want to acknowledge you and your role in evolving the game of capitalism through these conversations. So thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate it. We'll